What a profiles in lack of courage this is today, exhibited in the House of Representatives. But it does give us an opportunity, however limited the time is, to expose a lot of the myths, like this notion that the other side continues to perpetuate that Social Security and Medicare are entitlements. Newsflash, it's the insurance that the American people have paid for. 10,000 baby boomers a day become eligible for Social Security. The average woman in this country, when they retire, gets $14,000 annually from Social Security. And for more than half of them, that's all they have to live on. And yet these bastions of courage on the other side would like to cut these programs. These are American citizens who have paid through an insurance program, not an entitlement.
Coming up on Nurse Talk, with so much in the news these days, most of us probably missed the vote on the so-called balanced budget amendment. What is it, and why should we know about it?
We revisit an inspirational interview with renowned humorist and oral cancer survivor, Terry Tate.
And we have a Square Needle Award to present to someone who couldn't deserve it more.
All this and more today on Nurse Talk.
Welcome to Nurse Talk. I'm Casey Hobbs, along with my co-host, Shane Mason, and we are two of the thousands of nurses on duty today. Shane, so nice to have you back in the booth. Were you traveling?
Yes, I went on an archaeologic expedition.
Really? That sounds exciting. Where the heck did you do that?
Oklahoma.
Oh, Oklahoma. What in the world would you find but a lot of fracking?
My parents were there, and I went fishing. Mm. It was nice. Yeah.
Fishing.
It's nice to go to Oklahoma for a few days.
Never got into fishing. What'd you catch?
I caught one bass.
One bass.
Yep.
Too much.
Yep. I caught one bass and my dad caught zero fish.
So oh, that's always nice.
Just putting that out there. You do what you want with that.
So did you talk to anyone there who was willing to talk about their opinions on the teacher strike?
Actually, the teacher strike there has more support than I thought that it was going to. I did talk to quite a few people about it. I think that they are kind of getting it. You know, a couple people were against it, but for the most part, everyone was really supportive of the teachers, and that was a really pleasant surprise.
That's really nice to hear. I'm so glad. All right, so switching gears a bit, the clip we heard at the top of the show was the Connecticut Congressman John Larson expressing his opposition to cuts to Social Security and Medicare. This was before Congress voted on the so-called balanced budget amendment.
And in a moment, we'll talk with Executive Director of Social Security Works, Alex Lawson. Alex is a frequent guest on Nurse Talk and is one of the foremost experts on Social Security and Medicare. Together, he and his colleague Nancy Altman provide critical education, activism, and truth about these programs.
Shane, a few weeks ago, Paul Ryan and his Republican caucus voted on a so-called balanced budget amendment. While it sounds like a vote for mom and apple pie, every politician who supports it will be voting to cut Social Security.
Legislation that would surreptitiously steal Social Security's $2.9 trillion surplus has been defeated, but 97% of Republicans voted for it. Ryan and his caucus have so far been thwarted in their efforts to cut Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid because doing so is extremely unpopular. They would love to go after Social Security through the undemocratic reconciliation process, but because Social Security doesn't add a penny to the deficit, past Congresses have made sure that today's Republicans can't cut Social Security through that closed, expedited process, so enter this the BBA.
With us is the Executive Director of Social Security Works, Alex Lawson. Alex, so great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Great. So please give us the who, what, where, and how of the balanced budget amendment.
I think one thing that we agree on is that the Republicans are good at messaging things.
Yes.
So I basically refuse to call it the balanced budget amendment because it has nothing to do with that. And the name makes it seem kind of popular. It should be called the Reaching Their Hands Into Our Pockets and Stealing Our Money to Give It to Billionaires Act. But for the sake of brevity, I'll just call it the BBA. The BBA really is just a process change that the Republicans and their paymasters on Wall Street have been trying to push through either legislatively or through constitutional amendment that would allow them to steal our earned benefits. It would allow them to bypass the protections that are in place around our earned benefits. For example, with Social Security is a self-funded system. We pay for it out of each paycheck. It's our money. And that's recognized by the fact that the Congress can't use that money for anything other than Social Security. Congress is not actually involved in that process. And the BBA would allow them to steal that money. It's as simple as that.
And so this $2.8 trillion, they basically would not be allowed to use that, and they would need to start reconciling how much they bring in every year. Is that how that works?
It would basically just allow them to disregard the fact that that $2.9 trillion is from premiums, right? So
right.
People have been paying in, and they've been in many ways pre-funding their own retirement. So that money can only go. It's held in trust for the workers. And what the BBA would do is actually allow them to pretend that it doesn't exist. And by pretending that it doesn't exist as a dedicated revenue stream, they can then cut our benefits, which the consequence of is actually stealing that money. It is, like many of these things, a pretty complex process change, but they only have one game plan, and it's stealing our money and giving it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And that's what the BBA does through a somewhat complex process change that would allow them to do that.
Right.
So, Alex, what happens next then? Will they try to pass this amendment again, which I'm sure they will? And is there something else we should watch out for?
You should always be watching the constitutional amendment process, because the Koch brothers and their ilk have been, and I know your listeners know this, they've been on this same track since the Powell memo back in the 70s. Said that the corporations need to seize control of the state by doing this exact thing. So they have a long-term plan here. So it will return. It will return legislatively. It will return also through trying to get the state legislatures to pass that they want a constitutional assembly at where they will pass a BBA. And that is another path that they're taking. I will say that when they bring it up legislatively like this, and they don't have two-thirds of the seats, it is more so actually just saying it's a marker. It's like they tattoo on their arm or their forehead, more likely, owned by Wall Street.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what the BBA is. Because they're not thinking they're going to pass it this time. They're just marking who they work for. That's what you can take everyone who voted for it and say they work for Wall Street.
It's like corporate virtue signaling to Wall Street.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the Republican constituency doesn't want this either, right? I mean, other than these political leaders, you know, regular Republicans, they're going to be affected by this as much as anyone, right?
More so even.
Yeah, definitely affected by it. Again, the trick of the name is really powerful. So if you're actually just asking in a poll or something like that with just the name, you would find probably pretty high levels of support with Republicans and independents. If you then say this is what that would do, you'll find it craters to 10% or lower. That's always where the polling is when it comes to cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, cutting Medicaid, and our other benefits that we earn.
So I want to repeat, Alex, Social Security does not add a penny to the deficit.
Correct. By law, it cannot. It cannot.
Right.
Not just that it doesn't, but that it cannot ever do it by the construction of it. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's good. So how can people get involved? And are we getting the word out there? Do people understand that this is Paul Ryan and the head of the Republican Party's mission to get rid of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, any of our quote-unquote entitlement programs?
So you can go to socialsecurityworks.org. Obviously, we follow this stuff day in, day out, all of the different vectors of attacks that are coming at us. We're hearing that they're going to come after the Medicaid expansions and other portions of our health care, again, coming into November. But is that November that really gives people their superpowers? We all know all power is in the people. When we stand together, we can't be defeated. And during a political cycle, that's when your powers are absolutely magnified. What I mean by that is show up at a town hall, grill people. Really, you know, if you can't show up at a town hall, you know, use social media. Do whatever you can. Go to the events that they're having with classic bird dogging strategies and tactics. These are the things that we can do this cycle. And just make the ask simple. You voted for the BBA. Do you support cutting Social Security? Do you support cutting Medicare? These are the things that we can do to make sure that going into November, these guys don't get away with their, I like the phrase, corporate virtue signaling. I think it's more like corporate corruption signaling. And we're holding them accountable for the votes they take.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of these, Paul Ryan's on his way out of office. So these guys have carte blanche to do what they want without repercussions. So people have to show up and we have to safeguard these benefits that everyone has paid for and earned.
As you say, they are taking money from the most vulnerable people and handing it off to the most wealthy.
Absolutely. This is nothing more than a continuation and an acceleration of the upward redistribution of wealth, which really kicked off in 1980 and has not slowed down at all, not for even a single administration or year since then. But we are hitting a real turning point here because the people, they're not buying it anymore. They're standing up, they're outraged, and they're ready, willing, and are fighting back. I mean, you look at these teacher strikes all around the country, and if that doesn't really show our power, I don't know what else we can do. But that's exactly right. What we're fighting is this accelerating looting. I mean, Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, just one of Donald's looters in chief, he went to the American Bankers Association and he just said, give us more money. Give us more money so we can actually destroy consumer protections. I mean, it was so blatant.
Yeah,
it is.
All right. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Alex Lawson, who's the executive director of Social Security Works. For more information on this topic, visit socialsecurityworks.org or nursetalksite.com. Alex, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Just that our voices cannot be silenced when we stand together.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for being with us and for keeping us informed about these backdoor maneuvers. Very important.
You're listening to Nurse Talk Radio on Progressive Voices Tune In and all of our broadcast partners.
Don't go away. We have the Square Needle Award coming up next and a poignant conversation with humorist, author, and cancer survivor Terry Tate.
You're listening to Nurse Talk, where laughter's the best medicine.
Senator Bernie Sanders recently said that the fight for universal and comprehensive health care is the civil rights battle of our time. He's right. This is an historic battle of the will of the people against the most powerful special interests in the nation. Many polls have shown that we, the people, favor a single-payer plan 2-1, but we need your help to win this fight. Go to CaliforniaOneCare.org and sign up now.
California One Care, full care for all, for less.
What a profiles in lack of courage this is today, exhibited in the House of Representatives. Like this notion that the other side continues to perpetuate that Social Security and Medicare are entitlements. And these bastions of courage on the other side would like to cut these programs. Not by coming to the floor of the House of Representatives and having a vote on it, but somehow decide that they're going to introduce an amendment where they'll never, ever have to vote on what their constituents actually have to face day in and day out. These are American citizens who have paid through an insurance program, not an entitlement. It's called FICA, the Federal Insurance Contribution Act. Whose contribution? The American people's contribution. If you want to vote to take it away, have the courage to bring up a bill and vote on it. How about we increase the benefits
the for
the people of this country?
Expired,
who need it? I yield back my time.
The gentleman from Virginia is recognized.
We are nurses, so we cannot diagnose, prescribe, or treat. But listen to us anyway, because we like to talk. Welcome back to Nurse Talk. I'm Casey Hobbs, along with Shane Mason, and we are two of the thousands of nurses on duty today.
In a moment, we'll share an interview with humorist, author, and cancer survivor Terry Tate. Terry jokes that it took her 20 years to write her recently published book, A Crooked Smile, and you're not going to want to miss her story.
But Shane, right now, it's the moment you've all been waiting for. Drum roll, please. This week, our Square Needle Award goes to a deserving person or organization that has somehow put themselves in the news or otherwise come to light for a not-so-charitable act or cause.
And this week's Square Needle Award goes to GOP lawmaker from Tennessee, Diane Black. If you thought the healthcare situation in America was bad already, wait till you hear from a GOP lawmaker from Tennessee, Diane Black, who wants to make it even worse.
A Reagan-era policy known as Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, which prohibits emergency rooms from turning patients away, is apparently too liberal for her, as she believes that ERs should be able to turn people away at their own discretion. People would undoubtedly die as a result of this. It's a new low for Republican cruelty, but it shouldn't be too surprising given the direction the party has been going in.
And that's why Republican lawmaker from Tennessee, Diane Black, gets this week's Square Needle Award. And P.S. Casey, Miss Black is a former ER nurse.
Oh, that really hurts.
Bummer. Coming up next, a remarkable woman shares her journey. RN, author, humorist, and oral cancer survivor, Terry Tate, will talk about her new book, A Crooked Smile.
How do you keep going when the doctor gives you a 2% chance of survival? For Terry Tate, it was a blend of faith, perseverance, prescription-strength humor, and most of all, a heart that never quit.
A Crooked Smile, a memoir, which is on sale November in 2016, is Terry's irresistible story of her journey through diagnosis, surgeries, the labyrinth of modern healthcare, and into surprising new adventures in self-discovery. With her wry ability to illuminate the profound and the absurd, she invites us to experience her ride on the emotional roller coaster of fear and hope, devised long bargaining and bitching sessions with a very stubborn God, and how the truly meaningful and joyous gifts of life always revealed themselves at the most unexpected times.
Here with us in the studio is Terry Tate. Terry, so nice to have you with us again, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful to be here, and this is really a dream come true. Every time I was on the show before, I imagined being here with a real book in my hands, and here I am after only 24 years of working on it.
That's great.
So, Terry, let's start with the diagnosis of oral cancer in 1991, the doctors gave you a 2% chance of survival. So what was life like before the diagnosis and then suddenly after?
Well, I've said that my life was just starting to look pretty good. I had grown up in a sort of hoity-toity suburb where looking good was all that mattered. And I rebelled against that and, you know, didn't care what I looked like and was sort of goody-two-shoes, but wild and crazy at the same time. Mm-hmm. But right before the diagnosis, I had just met yet another would-be husband, and my younger son had just gone off to college. We got in a new house in the country that was so beautiful that we kept waiting for the real owners to show mm-hmm. up. And life was looking pretty good. And then with a little spot underneath my tongue, the whole thing started to unravel.
So how many surgeries did you end up having, and how long did it take you to finally engage in life again?
Well, I had one surgery for the first bout, and they debated doing radiation but decided against it. A year and a half later, I started having symptoms again, and it took them again a few months to diagnose, such that by the time I got the surgery, I had a tumor the size of a golf ball where part of my tongue had been. And that surgery was 24 hours long.
Wow.
Where they 7 times attempted to replace the jaw they had removed with my iliac crest and failed 7 times.
And you mentioned at some point after the surgery, you began to ask, why did this happen to me? And not in a self-pity way, but with some curiosity. So can you talk about, you said there's a soft voice in your head that you felt like was kind of guiding you towards that answer.
Well, prior to the cancer, the only voice in my head was the one that I have since named the vile bitch upstairs. And her not enough message was so ubiquitous that I really thought that she was all there was to me. Until the cancer slowed me down and shut me up, because it was oral cancer, long enough to really begin to listen to other voices. And I discovered in a fairly dramatic way that I write about in the book, abandoned sort of, I hate to say inner child, it sounds too California, but essentially it was a part of myself that I had neglected. The part that I shut away when I got it as a kid, that my needs weren't going to be met, so better not to have them. And this voice basically said, I had to almost kill you to get your attention. And so part of the healing for me was connecting with this piece of myself, realizing that we had a lot in common, that we both liked feather boas and Gershwin music and walking by the water, and that we weren't all that different after all. And then she led me to that voice that I refer to as my guides, because I live in California, so I can.
Right.
But I believe we all have that connection to divine wisdom, and that there's so much clutter in our lives that we don't hear it.
So how long was it between the second surgery and your realization that there was more to you than just the dark voice?
A long time.
Years and years.
Well, truthfully, the second surgery, they ended up, when the hip didn't work, they ended up putting a bar in to replace the part of my jaw that they'd taken. During radiation, that bar came loose and had to be removed in yet another surgery. And then the doctors all wanted to replace that bar. One wanted to use my other hip. One wanted to use another metal bar. Somebody else wanted to use a cadaver jaw. And somebody else was going to use one of my leg bones. And, you know, it was... And this was the first time in the saga that the experts disagreed. And so it was up to me to decide whether or not to have any of those surgeries. Mm-hmm. And I woke up one morning having asked the night before I went out on the deck and held up my arms and said, please, God, tell me what to do. And, you know, I was hoping that it would be like the big right. voice.
The big voice would come out of the sky, right, the clouds would part.
Right.
Yes, right.
That didn't happen. And so I went to bed a little disappointed. But the next morning I woke up knowing that I should not have that surgery. And they told me that if I didn't, that what little is left of my lower jaw would gravitate over time, and I would be more disfigured than I already was, less able to eat and less able to talk. But I knew in my heart that if I got into another patient gown at that point, I was never getting out of one.
And so hearing your true inner voice, it still was a period of time.
Well, no, I'd say that was my true inner
voice. That
was
the beginning, right.
Yeah, and I'd heard little inklings of it before,
mm-hmm.
When I was asking for guidance about which of the plethora of healing modalities to pursue, but it took a long time to trust it. Mm-hmm. But I did not have the surgery, so I trusted it enough.
Terry, in 1994, you took a writing class with famed author Anne Lamott and also wrote a wonderful foreword for the book A Crooked Smile, which you say took over a decade to write. Can you say a little more about that foreword and your experience with her in that relationship?
Absolutely. I actually discovered her and read in her book on writing, Bird by Bird, that one of the downsides of writing is that sometimes you see that spot in your mouth when you look in the mirror and you're sure that it's oral cancer, and the doctor will have to cut out your tongue, and no one will ever want to kiss you again, as if they ever did. And I tracked her down and sent her a letter and said, by the way, sometimes that really is oral cancer. And they really do cut out half your tongue. And I think you're the funniest person alive. I'll do anything to be in your presence.
So that segues nicely into the next question. How important is humor through this whole journey?
It is hugely important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my family certainly is up there on the dysfunctional scale, as most families are. But everybody in my family has a sense of humor. And as dark as things got throughout this whole process, we were able to laugh.
Which is great.
And that was, you know, I mean, there were lots of times when I couldn't talk. And I must say that witty repartee suffers when you're writing on an etch-a-sketch.
Yeah,
true.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'd have this really clever line in my head, and the conversation was way on down the road before it happened. But there were little moments of humor and moments of grace.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that I really think that moments of grace is what life is all about. It's not going to be all grace and greatness, but if you can be alive in those moments, it makes the other stuff tolerable.
What would you say to anyone listening that might be faced with a frightening diagnosis or really any barrier or obstacle right now?
What I would say, for me, the biggest lesson of all this is learning to like myself better. And although I look back at pictures of myself now and see that I was really quite beautiful before the cancer, I like myself better even though the outer covering is disfigured. And for me, the hardest part, other than the fear of dying and leaving my kids, was the fear of being on my deathbed and having the vile bitch show up and say, if only you'd done that macrobiotic diet, you wouldn't be in this mess.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what I would say to anybody in any hard situation, which is pretty much life these days, is to be kinder to yourself. And I believe that really my message is about accepting yourself and your life as is. I really feel that it's only with acceptance of things as they are that we get out of God's spirit, whatever's way, well enough that things can change.
So very true. So you said in the closing of your book, I would like to be as beautiful as I now see I was before cancer, especially on eHarmony. You bet I would, but wouldn't trade the benefits of loving myself from the inside out. And
it's
so
true.
It took this journey, it took the cancer, for you to be able to start that journey and now work and now live from the inside out.
That's right. And I feel like, I really do feel like it was almost dying.
Yes.
I mean, I'm a nurse.
Yeah.
I was codependent in utero.
Mm-hmm.
It took a big wake-up call for me to see that I needed to take care of myself and stop trying to fix other people. And the irony is that my nursing career was going around the country and talking to nurses about taking care of themselves and each other.
Interesting.
Because I believe in my heart of hearts, and I believed it even before the cancer, but now having spent more time in the patient role than I ever wanted to, I really believe that we are no better to our patients than we are to ourselves and to each other.
That's fantastic. Anything else you'd like to share?
I'm just really grateful to be here. And I really, really do want to just remember that not to wait for a dramatic wake up like mine and to really be kind to yourself so that you don't have to go through this.
I would agree wholeheartedly. The more you love yourself, the more love you have to give. And I can't say enough that what Terry says is absolutely true, especially for the nurses out there. Do not wait for a wake-up call. your ability to care for people is directly connected for your ability to care for yourself and to truly love yourself. There isn't a greater gift on the planet than that, for sure. Thank you so much for your time as a nurse, Terry, but also for your time as an activist and for writing this book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening. And thank you to our executive producer, Patty Lockard, sound design and engineering, June Miller and JMC Sound, and Taylor Lockard Research.
And National Nurses United and all the nurses on duty today, and of course, our listeners and guests. Take care and visit us at nursetalksite.com or like our Facebook page at Nurse Talk.
Coming up on Nurse Talk, a pulmonary and critical care physician discovers the power of compassion and communication in care when faced with her own healthcare crisis.
What's next for the National Medicare for All movement? Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United, Michael Leidy, sheds light on one of our country's most critical issues.
And proof that laughter really is the best medicine. The Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor meets for their 28th annual conference.
All this and more today on Nurse Talk.
Welcome to Nurse Talk. I'm Casey Hobbs. Along with my co-host Shane Mason, we are two of the thousands of nurses on duty today.
Thanks, Casey, and let's take a moment to thank all of our listeners on Progressive Voices TuneIn, iTunes, WFTE, the Tom Hartman Program, and all of our broadcast partners.
Okay, before we get started, Shane, with our show, let's share a little comic relief. This is from the brilliant Tracy Ullman as she plays German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Mein Chancellorette, we need to talk about a delicate matter to do with your image. Oh, they're not discontinuing this lipstick. Oh, no, mein God, no. Warm flesh is the nation's favorite. No, it is something to do with you personally. Something you started doing when you were with Putin. There, you just did it then. But you roll the eyes sometimes when people test your patience. You did it to Putin and at least I know spy of the Trumps.
I do not roll my eyes.
Yeah, I'm afraid you do. Oh, my God, I'm rolling the eyes.
And I always thought that I had such a serene and beautiful poker face at the summits.
I'm afraid not.
Oh, no, now they are going to know what I'm thinking.
Don't worry, my Chancellorette. We will train you.
At 7 months pregnant, intensive care doctor Rana Adish suffered a catastrophic medical event, hemorrhaging nearly all of her blood volume and losing her unborn first child. She spent months fighting for her life in her own hospital and during a series of organ failures and multiple major surgeries.
Every step of the way, Adish was faced with something even more unexpected and shocking than her battle to survive, her fellow doctor's inability to see and acknowledge the pain of loss and human suffering, the result of a self-protective barrier hardwired in medical training.
In shock is Rana Adish's searing account of her extraordinary journey from doctor to patient, during which she sees for the first time the dysfunction of her profession's disconnection from patients and the flaws in her own past practice as a doctor. Shatteringly personal yet wholly universal, it is both a brave roadmap for anyone navigating illness and a call to arms for doctors to see each patient not as a diagnosis, but as a human being.
Here with us is Dr. Rana Adish. She's a critical care physician and faculty member of Wayne State University School of Medicine and current director of the care experience for the Henry Ford Hospital System. Dr. Adish, welcome to Nurse Talk. So great to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So the introduction to your book is titled A Chance to Die. Can you share the significance of that with us, please?
Yeah, so coincidentally, my critical illness came at the very end of my medical training. I actually had just completed my critical care fellowship the very day that a tumor in my liver ruptured, causing me to bleed to death. And what I felt followed that sort of very long critical illness was really my chance to understand what so many of my patients had been through that I had been somewhat blind to.
Yes, it's remarkable. And, you know, nurses certainly experience this as well, that we make this protective barrier. So in the operating room, you heard them say, "She's been trying to die on us." What went through your mind when you heard that?
I did. It was terrifying. The moment when they were saying that, my kidneys and liver had shut down and I had already nearly bled to death. The baby I was pregnant with had already died. And it really, as a physician, got my attention because I realized how critical the situation was. But then he followed it with, guys, she's circling the drain here. And I remember thinking, my God, I can hear you. And in truth, that could have been the very last thing I had ever heard, because I could have very easily died that night.
What amazes me about that is you had a hemoglobin of 3, and you were still conscious enough to have a full cognition of what was being said, and know what that meant, and react to it with a hemoglobin less than 3. That's remarkable.
You know, adrenaline is a very powerful drug, and I think if your body, your physical body, is threatened with death in that way, you become so hyper aware of your surroundings in a way that it's almost impossible to describe, but every piece of data seems critical when you're dying.
How long were you in surgery? How long did that initial period take?
So that first operating room incident, when they evacuated the baby and they did an exploratory laparotomy, it was a few hours because they were searching for the cause of my decompensation. And because I was in hemorrhagic shock, I had to be transfused, you know, massive transfusion protocol over 26 units. And they actually just stopped because they were so worried about me getting even just to the ICU that they staged the surgery. They just closed me with a whip stitch and thought they'd stabilize me in the ICU and bring me back.
So did they know at the time that the tumor in your liver had ruptured?
No. Actually, the prevailing diagnosis at that time was HELLP syndrome. They thought that I had that very rare condition of pregnancy where you have hemolysis and your blood is sort of shredded. It actually wasn't until a year later that we found the tumors in my liver and understood the sequence of events that had caused that first night to happen.
And how long did the whole recovery take?
Oh, all told, from all of the surgeries, I was sick on and off for 8 years. But that first event, from the moment I got critically ill to when I went back to work, was 6 months.
So you went back to work in 6 months, and yet it was another full 7 years before you were fully recovered?
Yeah. Once they found the tumors in my liver, I then had to have a hepatectomy. I had to have abdominal reconstruction because they'd sewed me so quickly with a whip stitch that I developed all of these hernias that needed to be put back together. And then I developed recurrent episodes of biliary sepsis from the hepatectomy. So it really took until just 2 years ago for that to be put behind me.
And in your book, you say that this experience changed your entire outlook of what medicine should be. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, in all of my training, we'd been so oriented to the disease. That was what we were focused on diagnosing and treating, and in rare cases, curing the disease. And what shocked me throughout all of my illness was that although the medicine went so perfectly and was brilliant, and I survived unsurvivable things, that what was missing there was really a sense that I was seen as a patient, that my suffering was seen, that I was tended to in a way that helped me to not only be treated, but to be healed. And it was shameful for me because I really realized that as a physician, I had missed the mark. I thought that by treating my patients' diseases, I would ameliorate their suffering, when in reality, if you don't tend to the suffering itself, you can't really heal.
So through your Clear Conversations program, you're trying to address that lack of effective communication and empathy that you experienced as a patient. So did it help or hinder you bringing this idea to your own hospital? And what barriers did you encounter?
You know, when we first brought it to the physicians, I really thought I was trying to help my patients. I thought that what I had seen was that my physician colleagues didn't have the tools they needed to have these conversations empathetically and deliver bad news with great compassion. And what's been really remarkable about it is how welcomed it's been by the physicians, that we recognize that this is not something that we spend time training. Unlike nurses, I think the nursing curriculum around compassion is really something we should embody and emulate, because it's not in our training. So surprisingly, surprisingly, we haven't met with much resistance. I think it's a knowledge gap that we're aware of. And, you know, to be fair, it's a very hard thing to do, to go into a patient room and give bad news when you've had no training in it. To know how to do it well is really rewarding and helps with physician resilience and well-being as well.
So how has this changed your practice? How are you different now as in your job as a doctor?
I am so much more willing to enter those difficult spaces with my patients, to feel their emotions with them and just be present and not feel that I have to have a solution or answer in every moment, but to just hold the space of their suffering and know that together we can face whatever's ahead. I think in many ways I had skipped that part in the past.
And do you find that that separates you in any way, that's more painful for you? Because I think the opinion always was that this somehow, you know, to be separate helps doctors, you know, move through what they do. Have you found it to be draining at all or problematic that you now are interacting on a deeper level?
I have found it to be incredibly enriching. I think that story that we were all taught, that if you connect, you will be depleted, was a lie. And it was really propagated because they didn't have anything better to offer us. They didn't know what to tell us to do when we connected and felt feelings. So we're working to build a real culture of resilience for our caregivers, so that when they do encounter hard times, there's something to buttress them and help them to recover from it.
I think it's important, too, for people to take a look at why they're going into any particular profession. And it sounds like, you know, there was probably already something inside you that got awakened through this process. But I've seen some people go into medical or nursing, and I think that the reasons that they go into the field maybe make it difficult for them to expand their empathy, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very true. I think in medicine, we've gotten a little bit enamored by all of the biochemical sort of aspects, the human genome, all of the potential for medicine that cures. And we got away from our roots of really attending to suffering and the humanistic aspect of it.
Yeah. So once again, the book is In Shock. And can you tell us where our listeners can find it?
It's happily everywhere. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and independent booksellers everywhere.
Well, I've found the bits. I haven't had a chance to read the whole book, but I've seen your conversations about it, which are very moving and wonderful. So is there anything else that you'd like to share, Dr. Oddish?
I think just encouraging everyone who enters this amazing field that we're all a part of to really keep yourself whole and don't feel that you have to fit some mold that isn't true to who you are. If we bring ourselves and empathy to medicine, it will change to fit us.
Yes, great. And this is now a more rewarding job for you since you've been doing this.
Beyond.
Excellent.
Thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you for
sharing
your remarkable story. To learn more about this topic, visit Rana Oddish, MD. We're going to put that up on the website.com or nursetalksite.com.
You're listening to Nurse Talk Radio on Progressive Voices Tune In and all of our broadcast partners. Coming up, a labor-based movement for Medicare for All.
You're listening to Nurse Talk, where laughter's the best medicine.
We are nurses, so we cannot diagnose, prescribe, or treat. But listen to us anyway, because we like to talk.
Don't worry, my chancellorette. We will train you. I will take you through some everyday situations, and all you must do is not roll the eyes, yeah? You're a chancellor, not a gif.
Yeah.
All right. Du Trump.
We have to stop it, folks. It's so good. I did beautiful words. They were beautiful words. But the fake media won't report them. Germany owes us money. Yes, they do. They owe us big.
Yeah. Oh, mein Chancellorette, are you okay? Oh, Birgit, I kept my eyeline straight, but my powerful eye muscles flipped my entire body instead of flipping.
I think I sprained my face.
Welcome back to Nurse Talk. I'm Casey Hobbs, along with Shane Mason, and we're two of the thousands of nurses on duty today and also nurses that love Tracy Ullman.
Yeah, I forgot about Tracy Ullman. She's hilarious. I hadn't listened to her in a long time.
She is hilarious.
So healthcare is the crossroads where the assault on workers meets the juggernaut of crony capitalism. That's the term used by the mainstream neoclassical and Nobel Prize winning economist Angus Deaton to describe the coziness between the healthcare industry and its government regulators. In fact, Deaton argues how healthcare is financed and delivered is a driver of inequality.
Registered nurses see that inequity every day in hospitals and clinics where the standard of care patients receive depends on the quality and cost of the health plan they buy. Not only the benefits, but access to treatments, prescription drugs, certain facilities, the latest technologies, all depend on what you can pay.
It's clear the U.S. healthcare system's teetering on the verge of collapse and must be reformed. That's one of the reasons Representative Keith Ellison from Minnesota has taken on the lead as sponsor for H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act.
With us today is Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United, Michael Leidy. For over 25 years, Michael has organized, written, and spoken for Improved Medicare for All. He is currently the lead policy analyst for the single-payer bill, SB 562, the Healthy California Act, and a fellow of the Sanders Institute. He is one of the nation's top Medicare for All policy experts.
Michael, welcome to Nurse Talk. It's always great to have you with us.
Thank you, Shane, and thank you, Casey. Really a pleasure to talk with you again.
Sure. So in introducing your recent article, A Labor-Based Movement for Medicare for All, you say we need health care, not insurance, and that the fight for health care is not new. Americans have been fighting industry and crony capitalism for quality health care for decades. What were some of those achievements, and what role did labor play in that?
Well, labor fundamentally has set the standard for worker health benefits and has demanded of employers and, frankly, through Medicare, because labor was the primary mover behind Medicare in the early 60s, really starting in the late 50s, has established that basis of health care is a human right for the whole population. We haven't achieved that, but the programs, Medicare, Medicaid, employer-based insurance, those derive directly from the organizing, the blood, sweat, and treasure that workers have put in through their unions to win. So I think we can say that the achievements we've made in terms of providing care and also in terms of the quality of care that exists in hospitals and the organization of healthcare workers, registered nurses and others, all derives from building that labor-based power in healthcare.
With the recent decline of unions, the ability to fight for our healthcare in the same way has diminished as well. Say more about that and what can be done to strengthen the labor movement's role in healthcare.
What we need to do in healthcare is link the struggles that healthcare workers have with their employers with the patient's demand for guaranteed healthcare. And so what we find, particularly with registered nurses, is their alliance with the patients and the public both enables them to be advocates for improving quality of care, but also for guaranteeing healthcare for everyone, for universal healthcare. In a time when unions are under a lot of pressure, there's demand for concessions and takeaways, there's been a tendency to say, okay, well, we'll cut a deal with the boss. We'll become partners with the employers. That hasn't worked. And what really, in our experience at National Nurses United, is that if nurses and other healthcare workers align with their patients and the public, then we can move things forward, even though workers in unions are a relatively small share of the overall working population, organized workers can have a disproportionate impact if they ally with the public.
And so what are the origins really of tying healthcare to employment? Is that something that labor was instrumental in as well? Or?
Absolutely. And it happened during World War II. In 1942, in order to make sure that war production was uninterrupted and something that the country, I guess, could afford, they froze wages in the entire industrial sector, manufacturing and anything related to war production. So as a result, the government said, well, yeah, we're not going to let you raise wages. We will let you do health benefits through the employer, and we'll give them tax-free. You can provide these benefits, and we won't tax them as compensation, because, of course, they really are. That's when it started in 1942, and it got codified and really institutionalized after the war as unions realized, hey, we can bargain for health benefits that will help us recruit members, that will strengthen our membership support for the union. And that's really how it started.
Interesting. So, Michael, you say crony capitalism is winning, and the access to health care definitely is receding. So clearly we're losing the battle, but you think we don't have to lose the war. Say more about that.
Well, Well, that's right, because we basically created a system where every time we've tried to change it, it's further enriched the corporate entities that dominate healthcare. So the ACA actually, for many years, was very profitable for insurance companies. For-profit hospitals were booming in the early years of the ACA. Obviously, the pharmaceutical companies have had no decrease in profits. I think the number just in California for the insurers between 2011 and 16 was $27 billion in net income. So that's really what we're talking about. When we say money is the metric of medicine, that's Elizabeth Rosenthal's phrase from her book, American Sickness. What we mean is, yeah, the healthcare system for those for-profit hospitals or even nonprofit hospitals, insurance companies, drug companies, it's successful. It's working because they're making a lot of money. If quality and guaranteed health care is the metric, then we're losing. And that's what I mean. We've lost the war now where money has been the metric of medicine. Now we are building a movement that can transform our healthcare system into one that promotes health and is based on people's needs. That's the transformation.
And what about the idea of expanding Medicare?
Yeah, expanding Medicare is the best way to do it because we've tried everything else except building on the program that's popular and works. So let's Right. Why don't we try that? And as it turns out, we need to improve Medicare for seniors. By 2030, a majority of seniors may be paying as much as 40% of their income for health care. And this is supposed to be the program that provides security for retired folks. So we need to eliminate the co-pays in Medicare. We need to expand the benefits under Medicare. But the only way to save Medicare, because it does obviously provide benefits to the most high-need patient population with expensive needs, is to put everybody in that system. So that's where we talk about expanded and improved Medicare for all. We eliminate the deductibles, copays, and premiums. We eliminate the donut hole for seniors. We eliminate their copay and coinsurance under Part B. And we guarantee health care for everybody based on need, not just what you can afford. So that's why Medicare really can be the basis for this solution.
So we can change the game like we have seen with Fight for 15 and the hashtag MeToo. How and why would this work?
We have to see this as part of this broad upsurge in the justice movements. These demands for justice all go together. And what we've seen is that when we make this appeal explicit, say, hey, all workers have a shared interest. That's what Fight for 15 did in terms of raising wages. That's what Me Too does for women. All women workers have this in common, this experience. And in healthcare, we need to tap into that. All workers have this fear. So many have the barriers to access, financial, narrow, you know, not having the doctor that they need in their network. All those barriers create an opening to say, hey, we're all in this together. We can guarantee health care for all, not just for some. And if we speak directly to the worker self-interest, say, yeah, I can't afford it. Here's how we can control costs through a Medicare for all. Here's how we can reduce what we pay. Here's how we can eliminate those financial barriers to care that are literally killing us. Once we start talking about that, get out of the insurance frame, get into the justice frame, link with these other movements, model on Fight for 15 and build that mass demand, that's the only thing that's going to overcome the money. Money's winning, but people power can overcome it, and that's the difference.
What can people do to involve themselves?
Well, we're building this national campaign to win improve Medicare for all. Contact your representative. Make sure that they're supporting in Congress, H.R. 676. Go to the Campaign for Guaranteed Healthcare website if you're an activist. If you're a nurse, go to National Nurses United. If you just want information, go to the NationalNursesUnited.org website and get more information about how Medicare can guarantee healthcare for all if we improve it. Most importantly, I think, is the mainstream media does not give us enough credibility or attention. Let's write letters to the editor. Always respond on those articles online in the comment section, but especially letters to the editor. Make sure these newspapers know that the readers want fair coverage of this growing movement for health justice.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, for keeping up the good fight of trying to get Medicare for all and have a more even playing field for all of us.
Well, thank you, Casey and Shane. I love being on Nurse Talk. We couldn't do it without you, so let's all keep up the good fight.
Thanks. We like having you on for sure. We've been talking with Michael Leidy. Michael's the Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United and a Sanders Institute Fellow.
For more information on this topic, visit nationalnursesunited.org, sandersinstitute.com, or nursetalksite.com.
We just shared a moment of spontaneous laughter. While you were laughing, your whole brain was engaged. Humor generated a cascade of neurotransmitters. Humor has the power to heal. If we had you wired for brain activity, we'd see a flood of gamma waves. If we had you wired for physiological activity, we would see a drop in your blood pressure, a drop in your muscle tension. Psychologically, you experienced positive and uplifting emotions, even though you didn't know why you were laughing.
What could be better than laughter, and no one knows that better than the Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor. On April 12th, thousands of healthcare practitioners will meet for the 28th Humor Conference in San Diego.
On the phone with us is our friend Karen Buxman, who introduced us to this wonderful event many years ago. Karen, welcome, and tell us first, when and how did you become a part of this humor and health movement, and give us a quick overview of AATH, or the Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor.
Shane and Kate, it's so great to visit with you again, and I've been so delighted that you guys have been on this journey with us. We have the Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor has been around for over 25 years, and it actually started out as a small organization by nurses, Nurses for Laughter, and eventually it became this organization, and it is the commitment of this group to improve people's lives through the use of applied and therapeutic humor. And so I've been on this journey a long time. My background, as everyone knows, is nursing. I've been doing research on the benefits of humor and laughter for, this will mark 30 years now. Of course, you know, I started as a child.
Yeah. So talk about the conference and the title, Resilience, Harnessing the Power of Humor, and some of its highlights.
You know, it is about resilience. And in this day and age, people are burned out, they're depressed, they're tired, they're weary, and humor is a great means of helping people cope. But more than that, we want to help people build their bandwidth so that when they do get hit with situations that are ongoing for a long time, that they have that ability to bounce back. And we have some amazing presenters from around the globe who will be there. We have psychologists, we have educators, we have scientists, we have healthcare professionals. But they're all coming together for the common good of helping people become more resilient. And one of the special events that AATH is putting on this year that they've not done in the past, they are opening up the Friday evening to the community. And that is, it's focused on caring for the caregivers. And so this will be free for people who want to come, who are a caregiver, whether it's a professional caregiver, whether it's a family caregiver, and they will be able to hear the message of how humor can help and also be entertained. Our evening entertainment that evening is Yakov Smirnoff.
Yes.
Are you guys familiar
yes,
with him?
Yes, I remember Yakov. Yeah. Yes, he's very funny.
So we are very blessed. So the evening of Friday the 13th, people who are interested in attending that or even sponsoring a seat, you can sponsor a seat for a caregiver for $25. There's a donation button on the website for AATH.org. It is a nonprofit, and donations are charitable. But, you know, mostly we just want people to come and experience the Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor because it is such a powerfully life-changing event. Whether you're in business, whether you're in healthcare, or whether you're just in need of a little lightness, the AATH organization has something for everybody.
I laughed the other day. It was cool. just want to let you know.
Well,
I tried it.
Anybody who's listening on here, if you've ever made a patient's bed and have an overwhelming desire to lay down in it,
so many times.
To this conference.
So many times I have. I can remember being in home care and going to a woman's home in the middle of the day. And, you know, she looked at me and she says, you know, you look so tired. You know, you could go in the back and have a nap. And I'm like,
yes. Boy,
you don't know how badly I want to do just that.
Yeah. But is that a bad sign or what, when your patients are encouraging you to take a nap?
Yes.
You know, we have a wonderful sponsor, too, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, who very much know about people who are dealing with long-term chronic illness, you know, cancer, very life-threatening illnesses, but so many caregivers in that field. And so we're very, very grateful for them. And they're very excited about our work with resilience.
Great. So we've been talking with Karen Buxman about the upcoming AATH annual conference, Resilience, Harnessing the Power of Humor. This is happening April 12th through 15th in San Diego, California. And for more information about this, you can visit AATH.org.
So thank you so much, Karen, for being with us and for all your work headed towards laughter. We really need it today.
All right. Well, I look forward to hearing from you guys again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Laugh it up this weekend.
That's right. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. And thank you to our executive producer, Patty Lockard, sound design and engineering, June Miller and JMC Sound, and Taylor Lockard Research.
And National Nurses United and all the nurses on duty today. And of course, our listeners and guests.
Take care and visit us at nursetalksite.com or like our Facebook page at Nurse Talk.